Penslinger.com and Patiobooks.com present Borrowed Time. Borrowed Time is a free audiobook written and performed by Keith Hughes. This story contains events that may not be suitable for younger listeners. Episode 9. This is Nest Relevant with the story so far. In Episode 8, while I was still visiting 1987, I watched the video on a memory card that Dr. Bertrand had left with his younger self for me. In it, he told me about the existence of a second time device, and he asked me to retrieve it from his house once I had returned to my home time. He also warned me that if I touched the duplicate PDA while I was on borrowed time, my molecules would destabilize and death would follow. To my frustration, the video lacked any explanation of why we were being hunted and what had driven Dr. Bertrand to this extreme. It was then I noticed that the younger Dr. Bertrand had written the date of his older self's visit on the memory card's envelope. I used my PDA to travel back a few months further to talk with my old friend. I waited for Dr. Bertrand's arrival, and when he got close, I learned that the PDAs could track each other when they got within a mile of each other. I stood by as he met with his younger self, but then intercepted him before he could depart. We shared pie and tea in the local diner, and then he told me of John Felch's plan for world domination. That was the reason I needed to retrieve the second device and destroy them both. Unfortunately, it turned out that Paul Robbins and Glenn had surprised Dr. Bertrand in his home, and he had to use the PDA to keep the device out of their hands. Now he can't go back to his home time and is doomed to die when his borrowed time runs out. Now you know what happened last time, so enjoy Episode 9. Chapter 20, Back to the Future, Tuesday, August 26, 1986, 4:53 p.m. Ness tried to open his mouth to convey his anguish, but the words would not come. Dr. Bertrand met Ness's eyes and gave him a weak smile. "Do not be troubled," the doctor said. "This will only hasten the inevitable. What I have not told you is that I was recently diagnosed with a rather nasty cancer. My doctor has given me only a few months to live. That is why I had to lay this whole mess at your feet. I am not up to the demands this adventure would cost me. I am weak and would undoubtedly fail." Ness shook his head, trying to assimilate this information. "Nestor," the doctor continued softly, leaning in again, "I am sorry that I got you involved in my problems. It was a horrible thing for me to do to you, but I had no other choice. I hope you will forgive me one day." "I'm not angry at you." Blame and forgiveness were the furthest things from his mind right now. "What will you do now?" Ness asked. "As my life is now measured in hours instead of months, I intend to take as many of those as possible and return to visit my Evelyn. I want to hold her once more, back when she was healthy and strong, before cancer took away the best parts of her. I want to hear her laugh, to hold her hand." The doctor's eyes twinkled, and his smile returned. "I desire this more than anything else I have done in my life. All in all, the reward will be worth the cost, I think. And when my borrowed time is almost gone, I will send the device to you. That which has happened before will happen again." Ness nodded. The transfer of the device existed for both men. While it was in Ness's past, it waited in Dr. Bertrand's future. A drop of moisture rolled off Ness's forehead and into his left eye. He lifted his hand to his face and felt more moisture there, as if he had worked up a good sweat. Suddenly feeling weak and lightheaded, his eyes felt like they were full of tears. He looked at the doctor and silently pleaded for help. "Quickly," the doctor said, "how much borrowed time do you have left?" With great effort, Ness pulled the device out of his pocket and looked at the display. Through his watery gaze, he saw that less than 2 minutes remained on the countdown. The numbers were red and blinking to convey the seriousness of the situation. Ness turned the device so Dr. Bertrand could read it. "You must return now, or you will die here. Nestor, please do not let my discovery be the catalyst of your death." The doctor reached across the table and grasped the younger man's empty hand. The older man's hand was dry and smooth, while Ness felt like he was made of liquid. His mouth tasted like acid, and moisture seeped from his eyes. He did not know if they were actually tears, but he felt like they should be. This was goodbye to a dear friend.
"So much more I wanted to ask," Ness gasped. "To say."
The effort of talking was almost more than he could bear.
"I know," the doctor said softly with understanding. "But there is no time. You must go. Goodbye, Ness, and thank you."
After one last look at his friend, Ness tapped the return button.
"Bon voyage," Dr. Bertrand said quietly as Ness faded from 1986.
As Ness felt his pulse slow, he realized that for the first time in their many years, the doctor had called him Ness. Sooner than he expected, he was back in a bathroom stall. Ness had traveled a couple of hundred miles east and 20 years back to the future to return to the bathroom in the Detroit Public Library. The same chip paint, graffiti, and ancient plumbing fixtures greeted his return. "I seem to be spending a lot of my time in bathrooms," Ness thought wryly. The forced levity helped him not to dwell on thoughts of Dr. Bertrand's demise. The device now had a blue countdown indicating that his body required 5 hours and 47 minutes to fully recover from his trip to the past. It hadn't taken nearly that long on previous trips, but then again he had really pushed it to the edge this time. He already felt much improved as his body reacquired its former condition. He pocketed the device and left the stall to look at his reflection in the worn mirror. He still looked a little pale and sweaty, but he felt almost like himself, as if he were just recovering from a bad bout of the flu. He pulled a bundle of paper towels from the dispenser and dried his face, neck, and arms. Once back in the library proper, he made his way to the exit. A large clock over the brass-handled door said it was around 12:30. Even though he had spent almost 12 hours in the past, no time at all had passed here. "Wild," Ness muttered, shaking his head. Ness jogged down the steps and crossed a busy Woodward Avenue. He joined the group of people who waited at the nearby bus stop for the northbound bus, doing the same thing at the same place that he had several hours ago in 1987 gave him a disjointed sense of deja vu. A few minutes later, a northbound bus arrived, and Ness boarded it with the other passengers. He had a house call to make. The bus pulled away, and Ness stood at the side of the road in Bloomfield Hills and watched for a moment as it continued its trek up Woodward Avenue. He pulled his hood up and walked away from the busy thoroughfare along one of the roads that marked the distance from Detroit in miles. Dr. Bertrand lived in these swank environs, which was full of wealthy, important people in million-dollar homes. Unfortunately for Ness, the area also had few pedestrians. The conspicuous lack of sidewalks showed that most residents were wealthy enough to drive where they were going, and the Beamers and Benzes that passed by gave mute testimony that they liked to do it in style. A man dressed as he was walking in this neighborhood would stand out. Fortunately, Ness had a plan to avoid any unnecessary scrutiny. A short distance down the road was a squat bridge that carried train tracks above the road. When he reached the bridge, Ness dithered a moment, pretending to tie his shoelace as he waited for traffic to clear. When no vehicles were close, he moved into the brush next to the bridge and climbed the short slope to the top. Alongside the two sets of train tracks was a service road, which was little more than two ruts in the dirt. This unwatched path was what he would use to reach Dr. Bertrand's home. As Ness walked along, the ground began to rise in steep hills on either side of the tracks. Trees and other foliage capped the hilltops.
Behind that lush vegetation were the residences of the Detroit elite, safely shielded from this industrial artery. One of those homes belonged to Dr. Bertrand. Ness followed the ruts for about a half mile until he approached a tall bridge that spanned the valley. The concrete was speckled with layers of graffiti, and the ground was littered with broken beer bottles and other refuse. This was obviously the favorite hangout of privileged teens who dreamed of being inner-city youth. Ness crossed the tracks and climbed the hill. The first 20 feet were difficult, as the hill consisted of bare earth and loose stones in deep furrows gouged by years of rainfall. The trees and bushes near the crest gave him some badly needed handholds and cover from prying eyes. Reaching the top, he crouched and moved quietly through the growth to the edge of the brush. None of the houses looked familiar as he walked back and forth along the tree line. After peering into the third backyard, he stopped and reviewed his position, trying to match up where he was with where he knew the doctor's house to be. He groaned as he realized that he had gotten turned around and climbed the wrong hill. He descended the hill slowly, half climbing, half sliding, once he reached bare earth. Near the bottom, he stumbled and nearly fell the last 6 feet. He crossed a small valley between the hills, including the railroad tracks, and started up the other side. Once at the top, he was pleased to see that he had successfully found the doctor's house in the second backyard he inspected. Ness had been to the house several times for dinner and once for a barbecue party. It was the latter event he was remembering. It had been a small affair, only 5 or 6 people, but it had been an enjoyable afternoon. They had spent it out on the deck eating some of the best baby back ribs and baked beans he had ever tasted. Once during that afternoon, a train had passed below, and the doctor made a joke about his noisy neighbors as the train whistle peaked in volume and then faded into the distance, along with the deep rumble of the engines. Sitting far enough into the trees to remain unseen, Ness compared his memories to what he was seeing. The deck, windows, and landscaping matched. This was definitely Dr. Bertrand's house. Ness thought it likely that the house was being watched, but was hoping the watchers were not expecting entry from the rear. It was a risk, but a better one than walking up the driveway and knocking on the front door. Ness moved out of the trees and out onto the lawn, feeling very exposed. Chapter 21, Picture Show, Wednesday, September 10th, 2008. 2:14 p.m. Ness quietly jogged across the grass and up the stairs to the deck. He tried the sliding glass door and was not surprised to find it locked. A quick check of the windows on either side of the house revealed that one had been left open a crack. Pushing it fully open, Ness pulled himself up and put his head into the opening. Inside was a bathroom, with the toilet immediately below him. He kept still, hanging halfway through the window, and listened for a minute. The house was silent, save for the ticking of a distant clock. Ness shimmied into the bathroom head first, putting his hands onto the toilet seat as if he intended to do a handstand on its cold surface. Once his legs were in, he clumsily twisted his body and ended up sitting on the floor in front of the toilet. During this bit of gymnastics, he knocked over a metal stand holding extra rolls of toilet paper. A loud clang reverberated off of the ceramic tile, and rolls of toilet paper bounced across the floor. Ness held his breath, waiting for a reaction to the sound, but none came. He stood up, quietly closed the window, and fixed the toilet paper rack, returning the rolls to their rightful places. He didn't so much care about the state of Dr. Bertrand's bathroom supplies as he did about wanting nobody to know he had entered this way. He was sure now that the house was empty, but he exercised caution anyway and tiptoed out into the hall that ran from the front to the back of the house. He was in the back, with the kitchen across the hall from the bathroom. He crept to the front of the house and peered into the living room. Set into one wall was the front door, which was flanked with narrow windows that were blissfully empty of Glenn or his men. He crossed the room and verified that the door was locked. Ness moved through the house, looking for any sign that Glenn had been there before him. As far as he could tell, everything was untouched. Halfway up the hallway was the entrance to the doctor's study.
Although he had been in the house several times, he had seen this room only in passing. A large mahogany desk dominated the room, and the wall behind was filled with photographs of the doctor shaking hands with notable people. Ness recognized several local politicians and celebrities. He checked the desk drawers, but found only papers and office supplies. Gazing at the pictures again, Ness evaluated each as a possible hiding place. He stopped when an unexpected face caught his gaze, his own. Ness walked around the desk for a closer look at the photograph. Ness and Dr. Bertrand were shaking hands, a diploma case clutched in Ness's left hand. His professional photographer's eye noticed that it was slightly overexposed and a little fuzzy, but he remembered the moment. It was shortly after the graduation ceremonies at Western, in the same field house where his disastrous encounter with Angie had taken place. Tennis nets and hurdles had given way to rows of folding chairs and a temporary stage. They had posed for the doctor's frail wife, Evelyn, as she captured the moment on film. They had hugged, shook hands, and promised to keep in touch. That promise remained unfulfilled until he'd seen that newspaper article about a year ago. It was during the process of rekindling his friendship with the doctor that he learned that Evelyn had died of cancer about 5 years before. Ness had felt guilty that he had not been there to support his mentor through such a difficult time. Ness shook himself out of his reverie and considered the picture again. It was definitely out of place among the doctor's collection of luminaries and colleagues. As he stared at the photograph, Ness noticed that the picture did not lie flat against the wall as the others did. On the left side, there was a gap. He pulled on that side of the frame, and it opened on silent hinges. This was what the doctor had to have meant when he said it would be in a place meaningful only to him. Only he would find this photo important enough to dwell upon and look behind. When the picture swung away, a cavity was revealed in the wall. Ness shifted his position to allow some light into the space and peered in. Dr. Bertrand's secret cubbyhole was empty. Chapter 22. Uninvited Guests. Wednesday, September 10th, 2008, 3:49 p.m. Ness placed a hand on either side of the opening in the wall and hung his head. His head reeled with the implications. Glenn must have the device. He pushed away from the wall with a heavy sigh, but stopped when he felt something against his right palm. His right hand was pressed against the back of the picture frame, and he could feel a small lump. He removed his hand and saw only cardboard. Ness took his Swiss Army knife out of his pants pocket, used the screwdriver blade to bend the short pieces of metal that held the cardboard backing in place, and then pried it out of the frame. Taped to the underside of the cardboard, Ness found a small brass key. There was nothing else, no note or indication what the key unlocked. He removed it from the cardboard and put the frame back together. Ness once again scanned the pictures, looking for anyone else that might have special meaning to him, but the only faces he recognized besides the doctor's came from watching the nightly news. He returned to the opening in the wall and felt inside the cavity. He could not feel a keyhole anywhere. Then he squatted down and peered at the top of the cubbyhole. The lighting was bad, but it seemed he could see a slot for a key. He felt the area again, but only smoothness met his fingers. He pressed upwards and felt the surface flex a little bit. There seemed to be a gap between the top of the cubbyhole and the inside of the wall. He wedged the knife screwdriver blade into that gap, then pulled the handle of the knife up. Initially, he felt resistance, but then he felt something give way. Ness sensed he was prying a protective plate away from whatever was behind it. When he had pulled the edge down a couple of inches to where he could see it, Ness abandoned the knife, gripped the edge, and pulled. Out came a small sheet of clear, rigid plastic. He dropped it and again felt the top of the cavity. This time he easily found the keyhole in the metal door that the plastic had covered. Squatting again, he inserted the key into the hole and turned it. Glenn's car moved through the quiet Bloomfield Hill streets that led to Bertrand's house. Williams drove, and Glenn sat in the passenger seat. he was on his way to make sure that Mays was not slouching in his guard duties. Glenn could have easily made this check by phone, but these rent-a-thugs were not known for their brain power, so Glenn preferred to check in person. Besides, Mays had already failed him twice today, and Glenn's trust in him was low. Glenn was only a mile away when he heard a beeping noise coming from his shirt pocket. He pulled out the PDA that he had taken from the house and saw that the device had turned itself on and opened the borrowed time application. He mentally patted himself on the back for having taken time to earlier read the included help desk as he recognized the tracking alert. He tapped the small blinking red T in the lower left-hand corner of the screen. When the tracking display appeared, he saw that there was another device within a mile. "Relevant," Glenn muttered. Gauging the direction and distance, he realized that Relevant had to be at the old man's house. Glenn pulled out his cell phone and called Mays. "He's there. Check the house and grounds." Glenn closed the phone and motioned for Williams to speed up. The key turned in the lock, and the metal door swung down. Several objects hit Nessa's hand and clattered to the bottom of the cubbyhole. The first thing he pulled out was another PDA that matched the one in his pocket. He felt a thrill of excitement at the thought that Glenn had not gotten the device after all, but it quickly died when he saw it bore a yellow sticky note with decoy written on it in the doctor's handwriting. He turned it on for a quick inspection and saw that the borrowed time application was indeed not loaded. He put the fake PDA in his pocket with the other device and pulled out the next item. The feel of cool metal and hard plastic told him what he held even before he pulled the gun into the light. "Wow, Doc," Ness muttered. He had never suspected that the scientist even owned a firearm. Ness pressed the button to eject the clip, and it slid into his other hand. Seeing it was fully loaded, he slapped it back into the handle of the gun. He loaded a round into the chamber with a sharp clack. Before yesterday, he would have thought that carrying a loaded gun was unnecessary, but after his repeated run-ins with Glenn and his goons, he found it rather reassuring. In fact, there had been a couple of times he regretted tossing the gun he had taken from Thing One at the mall. He clicked the safety on and started to pocket it when he heard a noise from the front of the house. It sounded like the front door opening and closing. Ness flipped the safety off again and quietly moved to one side of the office doorway. Ness strained his ears for the sound of footsteps in the hallway. At first there was nothing but the chirping of birds from outside and the clock's quiet ticking, but then a floorboard creaked. Ness crouched a little, poised to spring up and do battle. A shadow fell across the doorway, and he tightened his grip on the gun. Ness saw the barrel of another gun poke through the doorway, followed by a large, hairy hand. Thing One stepped into the room, staring at the opening in the wall. Ness took advantage of the larger man's distraction and leaped to his feet. Raising the gun, Ness smacked the goon on the side of his head. The man staggered, dropped his gun, and fell to his knees. He groaned and shook his head to clear it. Ness raised the gun and struck a second time. This blow was harder, and Ness's grip on the gun was so tight that the impact caused him to squeeze the trigger. A loud crack filled the room as the gun fired and one of the pictures soared off the wall in an explosion of glass. Thing One sighed and slumped to the floor. Ness shook his aching hand. That always looked so easy on TV. He enabled the safety and slid the gun into the waistband of his jeans at the small of his back. Ness returned to the opening in the wall and removed the rest of the contents, which consisted of two additional clips for the gun. "Yippee-ki-yay," Ness said, putting the clips into his hoodie pocket. He returned to the unconscious man and picked up the gun from the floor. Thing One must have restocked after losing the one at the mall. The two large lumps on the man's head attested to the punishment Ness had given him earlier with the baseball bat and fire extinguisher. "Another lump for your collection," Ness thought. The prone form was breathing steadily, which Ness was thankful to see. Being on the run was bad enough. He certainly didn't need to become a murderer, too. He was interrupted by the distinctive beeping of the PDA's tracking function. He retrieved the device and looked at the screen. Ness tapped the blinking T with the stylus. As the screen changed, dread enveloped him.
Oh, crap. The tracker's directional arrow was pointing toward the front of the house and the road. The distance was less than 1,000 feet and falling fast. Glenn was coming. You have been listening to the audio book Borrowed Time, which is written and performed by Keith Hughes. Thanks for joining me on this journey. To leave feedback for the Borrowed Time podcast, you can post a comment on the penslinger.com website. Leave me a voicemail at 206-309-9171. Email me at khughes@penslinger.com or follow my secret web alias, Ed Gizmo, on Twitter. Reviews on audiobooks and iTunes would also be greatly appreciated. And don't forget to tell your friends about this podcast. The music used is The Hunt by A Big Guitar off of their Bellerophon album, which is available on the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time, be seeing you.